Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig, you're a big music guy. Do you like Alice Cooper?
He was big when I was in high school. I wasn't that big a fan at the time. I was into other stuff. But yeah.
Over the past week or 10 days, the title of one Alice Cooper song has been coming in and out of my mind. Welcome to My Nightmare. Yeah. Piney Point, take it away.
Piney Point is a story I've been writing about since 2003. Yeesh. Then wrote another column on it in October saying, hey, we're headed for problems here. And that's what the sort of the basis of the story in 2003 was sort of charting all of the things that went wrong that led to a crisis there. And so, over and over again, Piney Point, which is this big, used to be a phosphate fertilizer processing plant that has a, you know, as you see in a lot in the phosphate area in Central Florida, has this gigantic gypsum stack outside, which is the radioactive waste from the processing. And on top of the stack is this big pond of a somewhat acidic water. And the stack became unstable and the water started flowing on its own out of the stack and into a creek that flows into Bishop Creek, which is an aquatic preserve. Some of it was getting into Cockroach Bay, which is another aquatic preserve, and ultimately into Tampa Bay. And there was some fears that the stack would collapse and there'd be this 20-foot high wall of polluted water surging through this area of Manatee County. And so Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Florida Emergency Management, National Guard all came swooping in. The governor came in and flew over the place in a helicopter, and they started pumping that polluted water out in a controlled way, but still putting it into Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
And, so they were able to get it to the point where the stack was stabilized so there wouldn't be an accidental calamity. But in the meantime, there's this sort of slow moving calamity that they've now allowed to happen, where we're undoubtedly going to be seeing toxic algae bloom in the bay. And that's going to be bad for seagrass and bad for marine life. And it's a shame because the communities around Tampa Bay have spent billions of dollars since 1991 cleaning up the bay. And it was actually to the point where it was as clean as it was back in the 50s. And now I think we're going to turn back the clock.
Yeah, I was reading an article today that said essentially 15 years of work has been lost in 10 days.
Yeah.
And like you talked about, you know, this is something you've been foreshadowing or been on your radar for nearly 20 years. So here's a big question, and maybe it's not altogether fair, but who's to blame?
The story that we did, I was part of a team of three reporters. We went through all of the records at the Florida DEP office in Tampa, the DEP office in Tallahassee. We went through bankruptcy court records looking at what happened to the company that owned it. And ultimately what we found was that the company was exhibiting all kinds of problems early on that should have led the DEP to shut it down, and they did not. Instead, they looked the other way. They bent the rules. They tried out technology that had never been tried before and it didn't work, and wasted a lot of time with that. And that's what led to them ultimately. And this is, you know, really still kind of surprising and horrifying. The way they dealt with it then back in 2001 was they got permission from the EPA to load millions of gallons of this stuff onto a barge and took the barge out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and sprayed it into the air over the Gulf, figuring some of it would evaporate and the rest would be diluted by the size of the Gulf. But, you know, as we discussed with Jack Davis, you know, we've abused the Gulf in a variety of ways over the years. And, you know, here was one more abuse of the Gulf. But that the solution was, well, we have to put it somewhere and we don't want to put it in Tampa Bay anymore. So they took it out in the Gulf. Now the solution that they're talking about is injecting it in these deep wells around the site and getting rid of it that way. But they proposed that back in 2013 and the farming community objected very strongly because they're worried it's going to mess up their irrigation.
The farming community, let it be known, that takes advantage of this phosphate, which is largely turned into fertilizer, correct?
That's
so
true.
We talk about the problems with fertilizer. It's a problem on both ends, so to speak. It's the runoff of fertilizer into the rivers and streams and Lake Okeechobee and the bays and the ocean. And it's also the production of fertilizer by mining phosphate, which creates all of these innumerable problems you've just laid out. Not only is it the mine site, not only is it the roads you have to bulldoze the trees to get to the mine site, then it's what do you do with the toxic waste. And I want you to explain a term that when we talk about cow tide, red tide, algae blooms, phosphate, you know, all this sort of thing, nutrient. Okay, everyone says, oh, the water is nutrient dense. When people say nutrients, what are they talking about? And why is nutrient, extra nutrient, so bad for the environment and water?
Well, it's nitrogen and phosphorus, basically. And it's the thing that spurs those algae blooms. I mean, it's almost like putting fertilizer in the water for it to grow algae. And well, it works. It grows them and makes the algae bloom more intense and longer lasting. And it's not just coming from runoff, but you know, after they had cleaned up a lot of the sources for nutrient pollution in Tampa Bay, the leading cause of nutrient pollution was cars, because that stuff comes out of the tailpipes of the cars that are driving across the bridges, goes up in the atmosphere, and then when it rains, it was coming back down into the bay as well. But this slug of pollution that they've gotten from Piney Point is equal to an entire year of pollution from those sources.
Yeah, and you're talking about hundreds of millions of gallons of this toxic, nutrient-dense, polluted water that the algae is going to feed on. And the algae, you know, as it's any other microorganism, is just looking for food. And what it does when it essentially eats up all that stuff, it takes oxygen out of the water. So it's a double whammy and a calamity on an unusual scale. And I'm sure your phone started ringing as soon as this crisis began developing a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And well, it was interesting to see that 2003 story suddenly popping up on, you know, the CBS Evening News and saying, well, it's been a problem for a long time. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I guess so. I felt a little bit like Nostradamus.
Yeah. The best way to, and to, again, to fill people in, we record these episodes on Thursdays and release them on Tuesday. 5-6 days from now, when that episode releases, the news will be a little different. Like Craig said, the worst of the fears hopefully have subsided with folks being able to siphon some water out of this, pump it purposefully out of the fear of collapse seems right to be passed. But certainly follow Craig on Twitter at Craig Times, and he is updating this virtually in real time. He was reporting for the Washington Post this week on location. So for up to the minute reporting on Piney Point and everything else we talk about here on the podcast, certainly follow Craig on Twitter at Craig Times.
I should add too, I wrote a column about it for the Florida Phoenix saying this is going to basically make Tampa Bay like the other estuaries in Florida, all of which are struggling with nutrient pollution.
All of the news is not bad on Welcome to Florida this week, because we have a new sponsor, and it's one near and dear to my heart. It is where I live. It is the Amelia Island Tourism Development Council. I talk all the time here about everything wonderful on Amelia Island. Last week, I talked about seeing the snowy owl just off of the south end of Amelia Island at Little Talbot Island State Park, going back to the second episode of the show, which was about American Beach and Mavini Beach. Craig, you talked to our previous mayor, who was also the bartender at the Palace Saloon downtown.
The oldest bar in Florida.
You got it. We are fortunate to discuss Amelia Island a great deal here on the podcast. And Amelia Island, now that folks are being vaccinated, people are getting more comfortable moving around, getting outside, taking little trips. Well, Amelia Island wants to know that you are welcome here. And Amelia Island is open for business. And we are about to enter the sea turtle nesting season. Amelia Island is home to 4 different species of nesting sea turtles. We are almost through with the height of the bird migration, but there's still time to come and see some of that. The nesting birds will be here soon, the waders, the egrets, the herons, that sort of thing. Amelia Island is committed to protecting and preserving the island's natural treasures and maintaining this ecotourism paradise for generations of visitors to discover. South Beach is great. Daytona Beach is great. Panama City is great. If you are looking for something much more genteel, much quieter, family-friendly, check out ameliaisland.com and discover for yourself why I call this place home and why I say all the time I would rather live nowhere else on earth. And we also, of course, want to remind you that Welcome to Florida is brought to you, as always, by HipCamp. HipCamp, that growing community of respectful people looking to get outside for camping, glamping, RV stays on private land. Anyone with a property, and it can be just a spot small enough to pitch a tent, park an RV, something like that. We're not talking about 5,000 acres. You don't need a ton of land, but HipCamp needs you. HipCamp needs property owners across Florida because they are getting so many of their members who want to come down here and visit and spend time and connect to the natural beauty of Florida. So if you've got a place to share, get started today at hipcamp.com/land, hipcamp.com/land. And that brings us to today's guest, who is the state's climatologist. And Craig, I've been wondering, you know, you followed the environment in Florida, you know, environmental reporter 30 plus years. When did climate change more than air pollution or acid rain or, you know, the manatees and the panthers and biodiversity and extinction? When did climate change really become the central issue in covering the environment in Florida?
I started hearing about it in the early 2000s, but I'd say it wasn't until, I want to say 2010, 2012, that you really started hearing that people say, this is a big deal in Florida. Yeah. This is something we need to be paying attention to. Of course, none of those people were politicians, but yeah. Getting their attention has taken quite a bit longer.
Yeah. David Zierden is the Florida State climatologist. He works out of the Center for Ocean Atmospheric Prediction Studies at Florida State University.
Dave, how did you get involved in studying climate in Florida?
See, I did my master's work under really well-known professor here at FSU, Dr. James O'Brien. At that time, he was a world authority on the El Nino, La Nina cycle and how it impacts climate in North America and especially the state of Florida. And so I was well-versed in climate concepts doing my master's work. Then as I finished up my master's work, he took on the added responsibility of state climatologist. And he hired me on to help spin up the office and strengthen the state climate office. I was his assistant for 7 or more years. And then when he retired, I was promoted into the spot of state climatologist, where I've served ever since.
Now, what does the state climatologist do?
A simple answer is we provide climate services. And what that is, it's making the science and data accessible and usable for the public, for anybody in any field that needs it, throughout the state and even beyond the state lines. We've done a lot of work with agriculture over my time here and educating them on seasonal climate forecast. Again, the El Nino, La Nina cycle and how you can take advantage of favorable conditions or mitigate against unfavorable conditions. That's just one example. Water utilities really rely on climate information, and just the general public do a little of everything, even expert testimony from time to time.
Well, that's interesting. Testimony in what?
Oh, in accident cases mostly, or I've done a couple where there have been overruns in construction and delays because of weather, and they needed an expert to document whether there was or not significant weather delays.
Do other states have official state climatologists?
Yeah, absolutely. A little history. Prior to 1973, there was a state climatologist appointed for each state, and it was a federal NOAA program. And the state climatologist, they provided services, but they also did a lot of bookkeeping and routine climate and weather summaries for their states. Well, that program was eliminated in 1973. The states were encouraged to keep the position alive, but there was no federal funding for it. And here in Florida, the position went to the University of Florida and the Agriculture School for a number of years before it transferred up to FSU with the emergence of our meteorology program here. Similar stories in other states. The majority of state climatologists are in a university or academic setting. Others are with the State Department of Natural Resources, as in South Carolina and California. This loose organization of state climatologists in the mid-1970s actually organized and created our own professional society, the American Association of State Climatologists.
I would imagine that, though, that you have a unique climate to deal with since you're dealing with Florida.
Oh, yeah. Now, I was glad to come on and talk to you guys today. Two of my favorite subjects, weather and climate, and also Florida weirdness. So we got a little bit of all of that here. Classically, the state of Florida is mostly considered humid subtropical by the Köppen designations, with the exception of South Florida, where there is more of a true tropical climate, either tropical savanna or monsoon tropical. Where exactly that line is has been debated over the decades, and it's kind of a blurry line. I prefer to think of it more as two different climate regimes. In North Florida and the Panhandle, we get some winter weather, some colder temperatures in the winter, often several bouts of freezing temperatures, and we get winter rainfall from frontal passages and low pressure systems. The peninsula of Florida, basically from around Gainesville south, they have a different winter climate where it's an extended dry season from basically mid-October through mid-May, where most of the area only averages 2 to 3 inches per month throughout that extended dry season. While it makes nice weather for winter visitors, it can create drought conditions, especially when the summer rainy season is slow to begin. And it also creates a unique wildfire season where we actually see our peak activity this time of year in April and early May as we go through this extended dry season. Where most other parts of the country, it's late summer and fall is their wildfire season.
You mentioned two terms, climate and weather. I think a lot of people use interchangeably. What is the difference between climate and weather?
Weather is the current and changing day-to-day conditions outside, temperature, winds, whether it's raining or not, governed by the passage of discrete weather systems, cold fronts, low pressure systems, air masses. Climate is more the long-term patterns. It can be thought of as average weather over time, over months or years even. But that's a simplistic way of looking at it. It's more the overall patterns of weather rather than individual weather systems. Mm-hmm. Weather can be predicted out 7, even 10 days. There's kind of theoretical limits on how far in advance we can actually predict the weather. Where climate prediction is more predicting these long-term patterns.
It always struck me as being like in baseball, where weather is what the batter does in today's game. Climate is his batting average over the whole season.
Great analogy.
How have you seen interest in your position and the work that you're doing raise in the last, 5-10 years as the conversation around climate change, not only globally, but nationally, and certainly in Florida, has seemingly reached a new peak each and every year?
Climate science is certainly a growing field. There is a lot more interest. I do get a lot more contacts from both state agencies, local municipalities, private industry, wanting a better handle or better grasp of what is the current climate conditions? How can we anticipate they change? There's been a lot of good work on resilience and planning for climate change throughout the state at the local and county level. Organizations like the Tampa Bay Area Planning Council, there's a Northeast Florida Planning Council that's similar, that really is addressing sea level rise. And of course, kind of the flagship is the Southeast Florida Climate Compact, the partnership of the four counties down in the Southeast Florida coast that have been tackling climate change, resilience, sea level rise issues for over a decade or more now.
A lot of people say Florida is the state that's most vulnerable to climate change. Do you think that's correct?
I think we can certainly make that claim. Of course, we've got so much coastline that where sea level rise is and will continue to be an issue. We are the most vulnerable states to hurricane strikes. There's still a lot of work being done on exactly how it will affect the frequency and the strength of hurricanes in the coming century, some things are becoming clear. The upper limit to hurricane strength is increasing as sea surface temperatures rise and the whole global climate system warms. A new study that came out last year is that rapid intensification of hurricanes is becoming more common. And that's especially problematic when it happens near the coast, where there's little time for warning. So between those two threats, we can certainly make a claim as one of the most vulnerable states. And we are one of the warmest states. So just the overall increasing temperature trend will create problems with human health, agriculture, a variety of other different ways.
Can you explain about the rapid intensification? I'm not sure people understand what that means.
The exact definition is if a tropical system gains 30 miles per hour maximum wind speed within 24 hours, that's considered rapid intensification. As an example, Hurricane Michael, the 2 days prior to hitting the panhandle, it actually underwent rapid intensification for two consecutive days to where it became a Category 5 at landfall. Hurricane Harvey, a year earlier when it hit the Houston area, also gained that strength rapidly to a Category 4 right before landfall on the Texas coastline. So that's what we mean by rapid intensification.
We're tied to the warmth of the water that fuels their power?
Yeah, certainly it's tied to the sea surface temperatures and the warm water that provides the fuel for these storms. But also you need the right atmospheric conditions for this kind of rapid strengthening. And that includes low vertical wind shear, or where the winds don't change with height, and ample moisture supply, no intrusions of dry air.
You graduated from meteorology school at Florida State in 1997. We were talking before we started recording. That's the same year my brother graduated from Florida State. How have you personally seen climate change in the now, you know, pushing 25 years you've been a professional in this field?
This is an interesting aspect. Through the 20th century, portions of the Southeast region, Alabama, interior Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, even parts of North Florida, did not see the warming trend that the rest of the country saw in the 20th century. In fact, some analyses, it's even in the U.S. National Climate Assessment, shows portions of that region actually cooled in the latter part of the 20th century. And this was known as the global warming hole, because it was like a hole in the map. That was often used by those trying to be counter to climate science, saying there is no climate change. Well, since the turn of the century, since 2000, the Southeast is catching up very quickly. Here in the state of Florida, in the last 6 years, we've warmed about a full 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than any of the 20th century average temperature. And that's just in the last 6 years. Some other alarming statistics. In those last 6 years, 68, if you look at statewide average temperature month by month, 68 of the 72 months were all warmer than normal. There were only 4 months in the last 6 years that were cooler than normal. That included 31 months in a row over the last three plus years. That streak was broken this past December, where we were a whole tenth of a degree cooler than normal. That was the first cooler month in over 3 years. We've here in the Southeast, and especially the state of Florida, we have caught up with the rest of the nation very quickly.
How do you deal with people who argue, and I still hear politicians in particular arguing, oh, this is all just cyclical. It's normal. You know, it's not human caused at all.
Sometimes when you know the angle someone is approaching you at, you know, you're not going to change their mind. So it's better to not get too deep into that conversation. Another thing is, I have 2 degrees in atmospheric science and have studied climate science all my life. Yes, I know there are climate cycles. I know there are natural forces at work too. Yes, I know that, but you can't disregard the vast body of work on what anthropogenic greenhouse gases are doing to our climate.
At the same time, and I'm going to follow up on that, Craig, just to play devil's advocate, you know, we hear climate change being blamed, obviously, for sea level rise, the increasing strength of hurricanes, forest fires, droughts, flooding. How much risk is there in a knee-jerk reaction to blame every weather oddity on climate change?
That's a great point. Something I like to point out in when I give a talk or a presentation is I list the existing weather and climate threats, most of which you just ran through. None of these are new. They've been threats all along. We as a society have had to deal with hurricanes, wildfires, drought since the dawn of human civilization. And I would even suggest that even prior to anthropogenic climate change, we weren't properly resilient to these weather and climate threats. That's kind of the other way of looking at it. Now, as they worsen, become more severe or more frequent, it just increases the urgency even more to have a resilient society and anticipate and plan for these kind of weather and climate extremes.
Rather famously, the prior governor's administration was accused of ordering people not to even use the term climate change. Did any of that ever reach your office?
That's a great question. I don't think anyone ever found the smoking gun where he was directly quoted saying that or issuing that kind of edict. However, in working with various state agencies, the Florida Department of Health, the Department of Environmental Protection, I can say that kind of culture did exist, that reports were edited to change wording where it was deemed inappropriate, just that kind of thing. The culture was palpable.
Don't make the governor mad. Don't use those words, you know, and we'll skate around it. We'll say, oh, the Gulf of Mexico is getting more acidic, but we're not going to say why, you know, things like that.
Yeah, or weather variations instead of climate change. Yes, exactly. But then famously, the governor went on to be, Governor Scott was asked whether he believed in climate change, which is never the right question. The climate doesn't care whether you believe the science or not. It's not like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. A better way to always word that question is say, what is your plans or policy to deal with climate change? But anyway, he was asked if he believed in climate change, and he famously responded, well, I'm not a scientist. A group of climate scientists across the state even wrote a letter asking for an audience with him so that they can help explain the science to him. I did not participate in that letter. That was too much of a grandstanding play that wouldn't accomplish anything, in my opinion. But yeah, that was that kind of illustrated the attitude of his administrations towards climate, and especially climate change. One last remark on that is that now that he's Senator Scott, he did put out a statement on Twitter just last month where, let me get the quote right. As we work to address climate change and protect our environment, then on to say we need to spend these tax dollars wisely. So he actually said it himself this past month. So even old dogs can change.
Yeah. Change. It's like Rumpelstiltskin or Beetlejuice or something. He was finally able to get it out of his mouth.
Let me caution you, though. Yes, he now admits that climate change exists, but I tried desperately to get his office to tell me what he'd like to do about it, and they can't answer that question.
Yeah.
He's opposed to other stuff for being too expensive, but he has no plans for that he supports. So far.
Yeah, let's put that question to you, Dave. What should Florida at a governmental level be doing about climate change?
One, it needs to be both a public and private partnership or cooperation to address our changing climate. We've got to attack it from both prongs, both adaptation, because no matter how much we cut down our greenhouse emissions or how quickly or slowly we do it, the climate still has some momentum, is going to continue to change, and we're still dealing with all these climate and weather risks. So adaptation is going to be key. Hardening infrastructure where we can. Unpopular term, retreat might be necessary sometime in the future, but I'm not ready to go to say it's necessary quite yet. But also, we need to attack it from the mitigation side and reduce our greenhouse gas footprints, both locally, statewide, nationally, and globally. It really has to be done. And again, private industry will play a bigger role in that than people anticipate. If you notice, as you drive across the state, you see more and more agricultural fields being converted to these huge solar farms. A lot of that's being done by Next Era Corporation, formerly Florida Power and Light. getting ahead of the game and becoming more sustainable. So a lot of goods going out without direct policy direction.
Dave, you brought up a term I just want to introduce people to, because a lot of people probably haven't heard it. Everyone's heard the term climate change. Most people by now have heard the term resiliency, and resiliency is an effort to coexist with rising sea levels and increased forest fire and stronger hurricanes. And how do we manage this? And it's about becoming resilient, surviving these effects. Retreat is a new term, I think, to most people. And retreat is essentially pulling up stakes and moving inland, or abandoning floodplains, leaving altogether these areas that are not only susceptible, but habitually devastated by climate change. And that people fight change. People fought the idea of climate change. People fought the idea of resiliency. People will fight this idea of retreat, and in 10 years, we'll probably all be to a place where we say, yeah, you know what? Building a house right along the banks of the Mississippi River probably wasn't a great idea to begin with.
Or the Gulf of Mexico.
Or the Florida Keys, or, you know, wherever it exactly. So just to let people, when we talk about retreat, that is a new-ish term, particularly to the lay public.
Yeah, very well explained. And, you know, if that was a necessary step, sea level rise would probably be the first impetus for that. But I know even my wife asked me, shouldn't we move somewhere north where if it keeps getting warmer? And I'm like, oh, we'll be okay in our lifetime. Maybe our kids need to think about it. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, and the insurance companies are certainly thinking about it, you know, raising rates and so forth.
Oh, sure.
Based on climate risk.
Excited again to let you know about our new partnership with Amelia Island and the Amelia Island Tourism Development Council. Wants to let you know that Amelia Island is here and open for business. And when you are comfortable traveling again, think of Amelia Island. I call it paradise. Paradise to me has a name, and the name is Amelia Island. And we'll talk a lot about the natural beauty of Amelia Island, the beaches, the tree canopy. But how about history? If you're a history buff, check out the historic Victorian downtown. We've talked about American Beach and the great civil rights history. On the north end of the island, visitors can explore Old Town, the last Spanish town in the Western Hemisphere, and one time featured the Spanish Fort of San Carlos. You can learn all about this at the Amelia Island Museum of History, which is Florida's first spoken history museum, located in what was once a county jail built in 1935. Learn all about the history of Eight Flags on Amelia Island. And we, of course, want to thank Hip Camp as well, our longtime sponsor, Hip Camp. And I continue to get more testimonials from people who have signed up their properties with Hip Camp. It's family farmers, horse ranches, people with a little bit of rural acreage, and they just have a little side place where someone can pitch a tent, park an RV. There's no forced interaction. You can have that if you want it, but this is not a bed and breakfast situation where you're waiting on these people hand and foot. Landowners all across Florida earning up to $1,000 a month by listing their properties with hipcamp.com, because Hip Camp's got this huge community of nature lovers and campers and people who want to get out and see things and all over the country. And those people want to come to Florida, but Hip Camp needs property owners. They need space, essentially. It's like Airbnb for campers, and they need more property to welcome all of these people from around the country, and that's where you come in. So if you'd like to earn a little side income on your property around Florida, do so with Hip Camp. Visit hipcamp.com/land, hipcamp.com/land.
Shifting gears somewhat, Florida has a reputation for somewhat unpredictable weather or wacky weather. Famously, there's a meme or a photo of somebody's car where they're driving in bright sunshine, and you can see the rearview mirror. It looks, you know, it looks like the apocalypse behind them. What are some of your observations about that, or some of your best Florida weather stories?
Some things that a lot of our listeners may already know, but others may not, is the number one weather related threat here in the state of Florida is actually lightning strikes. That over the long haul, more we have more fatalities from lightning than from hurricanes, tornadoes, heat waves, any other weather events. So we've all heard when thunder roars, go indoors, but it's absolutely true. And the other big kind of weather-related risk is rip currents and drowning. Last year alone, we had 15 deaths across the state from drowning in along the beaches and in rip currents. So while the tornadoes and hurricanes get all the news, these others are just as deadly.
One of my favorite Florida stories to tell, and it's one of the first visits I made to Florida from Wisconsin and visiting my dad's parents in White Springs, and I was, I don't know, 11, 12, 13, something like that. I swear to God, it was pouring down rain on one side of the house and perfectly sunny and dry on the other. You could walk back and forth in and out of the rain. And again, me, young kid coming from Wisconsin, this was like being on the surface of the moon. It was so unusual, so exotic, so bizarre, that fascination with Florida and wanting to live in this kooky, wacky, unusual, remarkable place. That is one of the moments I go back to, and the weather strangeness here that I've lived all over the country. I've never experienced anywhere else.
What causes that? What causes that? So my mom and my grandma used to call it a rain gate, where you have it raining on one side of the house and not raining on the other. What causes that?
It's just the nature of our summertime. We call it convection. These pop-up thunderstorms, they're often initiated by the sea breeze front and the convergence as it moves inland. But these convective storms will pop up very locally and very quickly. So you can get that sharp gradient in rainfall where it's, like you say, it's sunny on one side of the street and pouring down rain on the other. The farmers in the area, it confounds them when their neighbor's plot got rainfall 2 or 3 days out of the week, and they were bone dry all week long. But they know that's the nature of our summer climate, and it just has to be dealt with.
You talk about lightning and the danger of lightning strikes, and I mentioned you graduated from Florida State in 1997, and that was, you know, the height of Florida State football. And here's an observation I have, and it's somehow related to lightning. I'm hoping you can explain it to me. Throughout the entire 1990s, and when I was in college in the 80s and much of the early 2000s, you never saw a football game postponed for rain now or lightning in the area. That now you can't watch a football Saturday or a baseball game or a NASCAR race without clear blue skies and the game being interrupted because there is lightning in the area. When did pausing sporting events and concerts for lightning in the area become a thing?
Part of that is we now have the National Lightning Detection Network, where through a series of antennas and sensing the electromagnetic pulses, they can triangulate exactly where these strikes are occurring. And we now have this network, so we have better detection when lightning's in the area. And also, while most of the lightning strikes are in the heart of a thunderstorm, it is possible to get strikes several miles away from the heart of a storm. Those are the ones that come on unexpected or where people haven't taken shelter. So that's the real danger and why so much care is taken that even if lightning's in the area, I think within 8 miles is a commonly accepted radius. It's better to just shut things down. It always baffled me why the teams would go into the locker rooms, but people would still remain in the stands. That's kind of baffling, but I think through public education, we're learning and people are taking a little more care when lightning is in the area.
One of my favorite Florida weather stories is from Punta Gorda from 1969. I'm sure you've heard of this, where it rained golf balls on Punta Gorda. There's this great story. Punta Gorda mystery, it's raining golf balls was the headline. And it actually quotes a police officer who went out with a satchel and managed to fill the entire satchel with golf balls. And they were still coming down there. And supposedly, I guess there had been some sort of wind event that had sucked it all out of a golf course retention pond and then deposited it several miles away.
I thought you were talking about golf ball sized hail, but you mean literal
actual golf balls.
Oh, that's That's almost Sharknado type stuff there.
we do get hail here in Florida, though, from time to time, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. A big risk and a big cause of house and vehicle damage and insurance claims. Absolutely.
How about snow? How often do we get snow in Florida?
It does happen. Not very often, certainly not every year, but especially up in the Western Panhandle, they're a little more prone to a few flurries here and there. Some of the bigger events that I can recall was December, I believe it was 23rd of 1989, where we had 1 to 3 inches of snow all the way from the coast of Panama City through Jacksonville, as far south as Gainesville, and enough where it really covered the ground, and then cold air afterwards. So it actually stuck around for several days. And that was the biggest event I've ever experienced living here. There was also what was called the Great Blizzard of 1899. And there's still a photo in the old Capitol here in Tallahassee of a snowball fight on the steps of the Capitol that happened, where same sort of thing, that there was snow as far down as Tampa, all across North Florida, up into Jacksonville.
I remember when I was growing up in Pensacola, I think we would get snow flurries about once every 3 or 4 years. This was in the 70s. But then I moved down to where I'm at now, down to the St. Petersburg area. And I think it was 89. I think it was that December of 89. And my wife and I went outside because we'd heard on TV that there were snow flurries there. And she had never seen snow before. And so that was her first experience of seeing snow.
We set the state record for lowest temperature. Again, that was February 13th, 1899, where it got to -2 degrees here in Tallahassee.
Wow.
The only reported instance of sub-zero temperatures ever in the state of Florida. That same day, there were only two cities east of the Mississippi River that stayed above freezing, and that was Key West and Jupiter, Florida.
Florida boasts that it's the sunshine state, but we actually get a tremendous amount of rain, don't we?
Certainly there are states that get more sunshine, the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California. I think that term was coined to make Florida attractive to tourists and visitors. And again, with that extended dry season throughout the winter, October through mid-May, it does make for a nice climate for winter visitors. So it's not completely out of place, but no, in the summertime, which is our rainy season, and we get these almost daily afternoon showers, the term could be applied a little more loosely.
Yeah. Well, I've often heard that some of our cities, including Pensacola, get more rain than Seattle, at least on an annual basis.
You've obviously studied weather for a long time. Hurricanes here in Florida are so famous and have had such an impact on our history throughout the entire history, from the shipwrecks of the Spanish galleons to Hurricane Andrew in more recent years. Is there a hurricane that you have found particularly interesting from a weather standpoint, or the damage it did, or just its unusual nature that happened in Florida?
Without a doubt, Hurricane Michael 2 years ago that hit the Florida Panhandle, Panama City, Mexico Beach area. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Panama City and still have family living there. Growing up, we always knew that the big one was a possibility. Michael certainly was the big one. Some kind of unusual or eye-opening aspects that from driving through the area and surveying the damage. One, there's a great video available on YouTube taken by a storm chaser near Mexico Beach or Tyndall, where they're in the eye of this Category 5 hurricane, and it's bright sunshine. You can see clear skies above. You can see the eye wall with that stadium-like structure of a fully mature hurricane. You can see not a tree is left standing. Prior to that video, as a weather nerd, I always wanted to experience the eye of a major hurricane. And I'll let the storm chasers do that now. I'm good with not experiencing in person. But also, most of the time with landfalling hurricanes, it's that right quadrant, in this case, the eastern eye wall, where the strongest winds are, the onshore fetch. Looking at the damage from Hurricane Michael, it was the western eye wall actually had the strongest winds and did the most damage. And it was that western eye wall that set up over Panama City, downtown Panama City, Parker and Callaway. And the damage was just catastrophic. And also the core of the winds held together so far inland with this storm, devastated inland towns like Bluntstown and Marianna, even Bainbridge in Albany, Georgia, well up into Georgia, just catastrophic damage as the core of these winds held together well inland.
Yeah, my dad's from Marianna, and that was surprising to me that it did that damage that far inland. As somebody who's been in the eye wall of a hurricane, yeah, you've got the right attitude now.
Oh, wow, Craig, do tell, oh, explain.
I got sent to cover Hurricane Hugo up in South Carolina, and photographer and I wound up holing up in a motel there. I'd say we were about 12 miles north of Charleston, and we didn't realize the storm would come ashore and then follow the interstate straight up the interstate. So it passed right over the motel we were at. And so, you know, you get this hours of howling wind, and then suddenly it's dead silent. And we went outside to see what was going on. And then, you know, so I started interviewing people thinking it was over. It was not over. And then suddenly, you know, the winds had knocked some aluminum panels off the entryway of the motel. Suddenly they started flying around like Frisbees, and the photographer's like, I think we need to go back inside now.
We did. Had to put Ron DeSantis on hold to finish your story there, Craig. Thank you. One last one for me, Dave, and that is looping back to this climate change conversation and the science behind it. What about these handful of scientists who the political right and the climate deniers would always bring out as, hey, now not all scientists agree. Here are scientists who don't think climate change is related to human causes and who do think it is cyclical. What about that tiny minority of climate scientists who denied the majority of the climate scientists?
I know some of these classified deniers personally. I can't speak for them, but I think I'm safe in saying that the ones I know wouldn't agree with your first statement. They do know that the buildup of greenhouse gases from the burning of fossil fuels, they know it is changing our climate. They're not arguing that. They tend to push back against over-exaggerated claims that the science doesn't fully support, or kind of doomsday or worst case scenarios being held up as probable. I think that's more the attitude of a lot of these, but then they get labeled as deniers or skeptics, and why their form of communication and kind of being contrary to a lot of the science isn't helpful. I'm not sure they're as far apart as sometimes characterized.
There are some wide varieties in the predictions of how bad things are going to get, and perhaps some people seize onto the worst ones and other people seize onto the ones that don't sound quite as bad. And I think sometimes there's not an acknowledgement that predicting the future is hard. You know, we're in an area where things are happening that we've never experienced
before. Yeah. And, you know, the best way to communicate the science is to present all the possibilities and also kind of a firm understanding of what is more or less likely and what the science is nailed down pretty well, and also aspects we're less certain about. If we can do all that properly, it can avoid a lot of this conflict.
What do you tell people who ask, what can I do about climate change?
Personal choices absolutely matter and is going to be part of the portfolio for fighting climate change. Electric vehicles, using your vehicle less. This whole COVID shutdown has shown us that we don't have to commute back and forth to an office every day. And we don't have to cool and heat these big office buildings. All these kind of personal choices, even the diet, we red meat is by far has a much bigger greenhouse gas footprint than a more vegetarian diet, especially red meat. I'm not saying we should all go vegan, but there's a ton of health benefits in cutting down on red meat aside from our carbon footprint. So personal choices absolutely matter, but they're not going to get the job done alone. We also need policy changes to really accelerate the weaning off of fossil fuels. And the best way to force policy changes is to vote. And that's the biggest thing that an individual can do is vote, vote, vote again.
Not in the same election.
No, we tried that.
Well, that's a kind of a Florida thing too, yeah.
I was glad to see in the 2020 elections, climate was becoming the central issue. Mm. And that was the first election cycle where climate was really much of a mover of the needle at all as far as these political races. So when the voters start showing that it's an important issue to them, the policy changes will come around.
When the people lead, the leaders will follow, that's for sure.
Thank you much for your time, Dave. We've appreciated it.
Thanks. This was great. Thanks very much.
By the way, I didn't wear the floral print shirt, but I do have a machete handy.
That's wonderful.
Zoom call, Dave exited stage left to grab a legitimate machete and show it to us here on camera. Very nice. What do you use that for?
Clearing brush around the house. Actually, I've got a machete story. For 2 years, I worked on a survey crew. And a machete to a surveyor is like a knife to a chef. It's a very important tool, and it's very personal. We kept them razor sharp, but you never use someone else's machete. That would cause a fight every time. Put a chink in the blade or something. Yeah, you were in trouble.
I too worked on a survey crew, and I too had a machete. So we actually have a lot in common.
The Hawaiian floral print shirt and the machete, the starter kit for Florida man. Dave, thank you very much for joining us. Yeah, right.
Thank you, Chad. Thank you, Craig. That's a very enjoyable conversation.
We were talking about hurricanes, Craig, and you were there for Hurricane Andrew on a previous episode. You talked about that was the last time you didn't vote. Because you were stuck down, and I say stuck, you were on assignment in South Florida covering Hurricane Andrew.
Long-term assignment, yes. Yeah.
You weren't there when the hurricane came through, but what do you remember about when the hurricane came through?
Just how quickly it had popped up, and people were not really prepared for it. And the other thing, too, is it was a very compact storm. It wasn't very wide at all. I want to say it was like 60 miles wide. And so the path of destruction that it cut through South Florida was a very narrow one, but the places it hit were just absolutely devastated. One of the National Guard officials said it looked like a bomb had gone off.
Yeah.
And it had sort of an indescribable smell because it had, you know, flattened not just the houses, but disrupted the sewer system and all kinds of other problems.
Newest sponsor, which is Amelia Island and the Amelia Island Tourism Development Council, their first episode with Welcome to Florida. And we want to welcome them. And, you know, I talk about Amelia Island on the podcast all of the time because that's where I live. And I was attracted to this area's incredible natural beauty, the proximity to Jacksonville. It's only 30 minutes from the Jacksonville International Airport. You can get downtown. The great beach is right here. There's free parking. It's got this historic Victorian downtown, wonderful birding. And Amelia Island, and we talk about this on the podcast all the time, is committed to protecting and preserving the island's natural treasures and maintaining this ecotourism paradise for generations of visitors to discover. And whether you're into family beach vacations, fine dining, high-end resorts, kayaking, bird watching, wildlife spotting, or just taking it easy in a classic small southern town, Amelia Island is the spot for you for your next long weekend, for your next week's vacation. Check out ameliaisland.com. Come on over, say hello. You will not regret doing so. And one of my goals for 2021, Craig, as we begin to move around a little bit more freely and get out and about, I want to bring you to Amelia Island and show you all the sights.
Let's see it. One thing I forgot to ask, Dave, I'm kicking myself. I got into a discussion the other day with someone about whether or not Florida has four seasons. And I contend that it does.
Oh, absolutely.
They're not the ones you know necessarily think
of. Okay, lay them on me.
I contend that the seasons are, number one, road construction.
Sure.
Number two, spring training. number three, oh my God, it's so hot and here comes a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And then number four is, oh, here come the snowbirds.
Yeah. And of course, we have to thank HipCamp, which is our initial sponsor, our original sponsor, and landowners all across Florida, from all the way up here in Northeast Florida and Amelia Island, all the way down by Craig and St. Pete, and are earning money hosting outdoor enthusiasts on their property with HipCamp. Now, HipCamp is a growing community of respectful people looking to get outside for camping, glamping, RV stays on private land. Anyone with property that helps people connect with nature can be a HipCamp host. All you need is that flat spot where someone can pitch a tent or park an RV. So if you've got a place to share, get started today. HipCamp.com/land. HipCamp.com/land.